Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Market insight and analysis. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm David Faber with Sarah Eisen and Mike Santoli. We are live post-line at the New York Stock Exchange. Carl and Jim have the morning off. Let's give you a look at futures. You just heard Becky say we have taken a bit of a turn lower, at least it would appear, when we open. We're going to be down rather substantially on some of the broader averages. Let's get to our roadmap this morning. It starts with the banks, JP Morgan, Citi, Wells Fargo. They all reported earnings, all appear to have been fairly strong. We're going to break down the quarters. Plus, BlackRock now managing nearly $10.5 trillion in assets. We're joined exclusively by Chairman and CEO Larry Fink. That'll be later this hour.
We're also watching the semis this morning. Qualcomm, Intel, AMD, and NVIDIA all moving lower ahead of the open. China reportedly telling its telecom carriers to phase out foreign chips.
I want to start off with the banks and with that downturn in the market as well. Of course, earnings season kicks off with the likes of J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo and Citi, for example. Mike, I'd love to just turn to you quickly and just get a sense on the market as well.
Yeah.
We had an interesting day yesterday with that move up in Apple shares, particularly as the day went on. Obviously, moved the Nasdaq appreciably higher. But what do we think is behind some of the weakness we're seeing?
Well,
beyond these bank earnings, which at the worst are a mixed picture.
Yeah, I don't think it's bank earnings necessarily the catalyst. Yesterday, the indexes were rescued by not just Apple bouncing on some reports about some AI MacBooks and whatnot, but Nvidia going up 4%. Because this is the market we have. When we get nervous about macro and yields and inflation, and we've had a 10% pullback in Nvidia and some of the other AI stocks, well, it's the market, when it gets defensive, actually goes into the growthy secular names. So I think that was yesterday. What we have now is a market that has been sort of chopping around very familiar levels for about 4 weeks. I think no matter what you thought heading into this week, the picture did not get any less complicated with what we learned this week. In terms of inflation being sticky, repricing the Fed's path, bond yields going up to multi-month highs, I don't think that we have to have a strong specific rationale for why gold is going vertical to say maybe when gold is going vertical, things aren't necessarily as settled as we'd like them to be. So what we have this morning is, again, going to test the lower end of this S&P range. It's around 5150. And geopolitical upset is obviously in the mix. You have oil rising. This has been a feature of this market, especially ahead of weekends, where normally you have the volatility index backing off because you're going to be closed for 2 days. And today it's popping again. And it's obviously a volatile mix on a limited basis, at least. But then we had the hopefully there's no escalation of any sort. Monday, you have a relief trade.
Well, there's a Sternal report that Israel's preparing for a direct attack from Iran on southern or northern Israel as soon as Friday or Saturday, according to a person familiar with the matter. Iran's been public with the threats. And you have, just to reiterate, Mike, you have Brent crude oil above $91 a barrel. You have WTI crude oil surging at the same time where the dollar is surging and gold is surging. And usually those things don't happen together because gold and oil are priced in dollars. They usually go in other directions. So there's definitely a safe haven flight right now. And I would also mention that treasuries are catching a bid today as well. So it's not like high rates are spooking the market this morning because treasuries are getting bid.
Yeah. And of course, as we're sort of combining here, banks and the broader market, I'll come to JP Morgan. Not the numbers themselves, more the comments on the media call from Jamie Dimon. We already got a sense from this from his annual letter, which came out early in the week. But, he once again is saying, I'm not predicting a recession or no recession. I don't know what the future portends of all the things that we're talking about. But he does continue to say, Sarah, his own personal belief is things, the price in the markets is probably too happy. And I think the chance of bad outcomes is higher than other people may think. Not projecting them, just saying they may have you have to look for a potential range of outcomes. I'm working here off a transcript that's not exactly
I think we have a quote where he cites exactly what he's worried about, which are persistent themes that he has been worried about. Number of significant forces, according to Diamond. The global landscape is unsettling. Terrible wars and violence. Yes. He mentions that again. Continue to cause suffering, and geopolitical tensions are growing. Second, he says there seems to be a very large number of persistent inflationary pressures, which may likely continue. And finally, he says we've never truly experienced the full effect of quantitative tightening on this scale. He has been warning about this for years. So far, the market hasn't really felt it, the move from $9 trillion to $780 billion.
That was from the earnings release, not his media call. But yes, that's right.
But he sort of highlights the three buckets that I think they're worried about. If you look at the overall earnings numbers, though, I mean, they lifted net interest income forecast. Maybe the street was looking for more on that, given how much we've pared back Fed interest rate cuts. But that seems to be one of the primary areas of focus here for banks.
It is. And I think you also have to emphasize how much J.P. Morgan, the stock, has outperformed everything else in the group.
Up 15% this year into the
release. And I mean, over the last 2 years, it's basically, you know, ahead of Bank of America. Bank of America is really the closest comp, okay? Bank of America trades at 1x book. J.P. Morgan trades at 1.8. It's got, like, I don't know, 75% percentage point outperformance in the stock till that point. It's got double the market cap of B of A with, like, 40% more assets. So it just tells you the market has decided that perhaps because the CEO is always worried about what could go wrong, even as things look good in the business, they're willing to say that this is the bank that survives almost, you know, any environment. And so that's the context in which you back off 3% when you don't raise net interest margin guidance as much as people were thinking.
$89 billion is the new NII forecast, and I guess it was $90 billion in 2023, but that's still better than the $88 billion that they previously expected.
Yeah. There was also a reserve release, which means that credit looked better than they
were anticipating. Yeah.
And so that's a part of the story that continues to really support both, you know, the banks in general and the overall, you know, economic outlook. I mean, I think the banks, the reason we have to focus so much on the net interest piece of it is it's really the main swing factor, along with capital markets and deals. And that's been really active. Massive corporate bond issuance in the first quarter. J.P. Morgan gets their share of that. We got some IPOs. That's good. But the market usually doesn't pay a lot in advance for that type
of
business.
No, it's not like it's a growth business right now overall, banking. It's not a growth
business.
Right. That said, to your point, they have a return on equity of 17%. I mean, you know, just to put it in perspective as to why, to Mike's point, J.P. Morgan gets such a premium to many other banks. I mean, Citi, which is working its way through this massive restructuring, and you've sat down with Jane Fraser a couple of times, I know, Sarah, we're talking about ROE of 6.6% in the first quarter.
Yeah.
Not to mention Wells Fargo at roughly, let's call it 10, a little over 10%. So that just does put in perspective why there is a willingness, Mike, to pay more for J.P. Morgan and or at least a dollar of earnings more on a multiple basis.
Mike Mayo put it well, the bank analyst at Wells Fargo. He said it's J.P. Morgan is a call option on a more hawkish Fed in the short term, capital relief from Basel III, another theme, and best-in-class national deposit share. And that's sort of why J.P. Morgan has gotten a premium. Even though you said banking not a growth business, really strong results from both Citi, I noticed, up 32% in investment banking and J.P. Morgan, which was up double digits as well, 27% the investment banking.
Yeah, a year ago, I mean, the first quarter of last year was like as bad as it gets. But no, you're absolutely right that that's a good swing factor. It's just that the banks don't no longer participate. They don't really have great leverage to a really booming U.S. economy as much as they used to. A lot happens outside. They're overcapitalized. They're forced to hold a lot more capital. They can't do wild, risky stuff as much as they used to. So I think they're just more steady, which is a good thing for the system. You know,
you would think so, although something they're arguing about, certainly the next round of potential capital requirements as well, which they feel like is overshooting. We talked a lot about private credit as well and the market share that it's taken in terms of an area that used to be quite profitable for many of the banks that they are sort of fighting back on to a certain extent through lower pricing, basically here financing in terms of deals and the like, or the large credit needs of so many companies. Private credit, obviously, I mean, we've covered it pretty closely this last year, has
just exploded
through the alternative asset managers, whether it be Apollo or on and on from there.
KKR,
HPS, Blue Owl, it just goes on.
So there's an interesting divergence also shaping up between expectations for the big banks, which continues to be strong, and the regional banks, which we're going to get more of next week. And this idea that the more hawkish Fed or fewer interest rate cuts is very helpful to the big banks and their net interest income. And while it is helpful to the regionals, too, they get hit more with bad loans and bad credit quality and issues with deposits.
And their deposit costs go up.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the longer that the Fed stays at 5 3/8, and that's basically what you're getting in money markets, the harder it is if you're a bank to compete for deposits. And that's been, it's not so much like a deposit flight issue. It's more just it raises your costs and you have to, you know, try to keep up with it. But yeah, the regional banks have, with the sell-off in bonds, again, it creates more focus on what the ones that have a little bit exposure in terms of unrealized losses. A lot of that's working its way through. I think it's much more about, you know, if the economy hangs together, they're going to be fine. They're trying to hold these prices that are well above the March 2023 lows.
Yeah. And before we go, just to come back to the broader markets again to refresh people, we are going to look for a down open here. But, you know, mentioned Apple at the very top. I mean, I think that was the biggest move Apple's seen in, what, 11 years? I'll leave it to you. I don't want to say something.
I think it was
many years in terms of
4% daily move. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, it just shows you how the market gets very twitchy on these days when it's decided that it's going to.
Just since last May. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought it was even longer than that.
It's a pretty good size move.
11 months. 11
in
months.
In a $2 plus trillion dollar company. This has been the rotational action. Yesterday was actually kind of a weak day in the market. You had most stocks down, but the index managed to hang in there.
Alphabet and Amazon also, though, as they both sort of. I mean, Amazon in particular was very close to that $2 trillion mark that we sort of follow. And you pointed out NVIDIA as well. Do we expect follow through yesterday at the end of
one
of our shows? I forget which one, Mike. We were talking about the narrowing is the word you used in terms of the market overall, as opposed to the broadening theme we've been stressing for the last few months.
It's definitely flagged quite a bit. I mean, that's when higher yields bite is on the majority of stocks. In fact, if you looked at sort of the equal weighted S&P relative to the market cap weighted, you know, it's back on its lows, more or less. So it's not as if there's been a lot of progress. And, you know, if you're an index owner, you kind of don't care. The overall market hangs in there. I mean, I think you have to sort of stack up what we know and what we think we know. It's a bull market. The strength and persistence of the bull market in the five-month run we had off the October low is of the sort that usually means it's not the end of it. In other words, it's persistent 6 and 12 months later. So you know all those things. What you don't know is what happens in between. And there has to be some give back. We're in one of the top 12 or 13 longest stretches of the last 80 years without the S&P at least touching its 50-day average. That's kind of technical mumbo jumbo. All it means is market's up a lot, hasn't backed off much as it usually does.
And there are a few other negative catalysts we didn't even mention. The semis, which have been the market leaders this year, they're weak, especially Intel and AMD on this report from the Journal that China continues to crack down and is trying to wean the telecom providers off of American ships.
And yeah,
that would
and
hurt
are doing
those two
it.
In particular,
that
and
they
that they have set a deadline.
Yeah, the CPUs in particular made by the likes of AMD and Intel are very important. And it extends beyond telecom, obviously, as well, into just the PCs that are made and provided for in China as well. But you can see the weakness in particular, I think, AMD down as much as perhaps 3%.
Yeah, phase out by 2027 is the headline. And then the only other sort of negative data point from China was the export data. I don't know if you saw it, down 7.5%. And that is worse than it has been. And also, it's worse given that there was some optimism lately on China, particularly in terms of exports. This was a downside surprise. Imports were also down 2%. So just speaking to the persistent weakness in China's economy. And just when some of the hedge fund managers get a little bit more bullish on China, we saw outflows in Japan for the first week last week and inflows into China. Disappointing data.
Yeah, it's kind of the new widowmaker is the trade is the pick the low in Chinese risk assets. But,
hard to do.
We'll see.
All right, we've got a big morning on tap here. BlackRock CEO Larry Fink will join us exclusively here at Post 9 on a big earnings day for him and for financials in general. And in the next hour, Nike going for gold. We've got an exclusive interview with CEO John Donahoe as they unveil their new Olympic kits. Taking a look at futures here as we head into the opening bell. As we mentioned, down session, Dow down almost 300 points ahead of the open. NASDAQ futures down 176, given back yesterday's big tech gains. More Squawk on the Street, straight ahead.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to fight rising costs of inflation or pay off your debt or anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, can help. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been helping great investors like you. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking for tips, Yahoo Finance makes it super easy by putting all the tools and data you need in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. That's how Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you take a look at your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective is what great investors need. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
BlackRock reporting financials and also that it has record assets under management. They've now reached $10.5 trillion as of the first quarter. The company also posting a 36% jump in its profits. CEO Larry Fink will join us later this hour. We'll talk about the numbers and, of course, I'm sure the overall economy. You know, $10.5 trillion is a pretty big number.
It is.
I can remember when it was below a trillion, I think. I can go back a long way. Fixed income, interestingly, was the largest inflows, I think, at $42 billion for the quarter, opposed to equities at $18
billion.
Steady
total net inflows, yeah. I think he characterized it as $76 billion net inflows in long-term, so kind of non-cash type funds. So, yeah, it's moving right along. Obviously, the markets help in terms of getting the overall AUM up. And the company's built in a way to be somewhat agnostic as to what asset class, what strategy, active, passive, retail, institutional. I think that's very much by design. And so they just sort of capture it across the board. So it seems like, you know, pretty good performance. They're obviously using their scale to their advantage where there is earnings leverage in the model because, you know, it doesn't necessarily take more people or cost to manage an extra $60 billion in a given quarter.
$62 billion inflows for ETFs. That's the iShares business. Obviously, that's strong,
but lower fee. So that's always the trade-off.
Yeah, I mean, right. They did benefit, obviously, from performance overall of the market, and therefore performance fees fairly strong. Although you can see kind of a mixed reaction. A number of the analysts saying just generally a very, a positive take on the quarter, a bit better than anticipated. Margins came in fairly good on lower expenses.
And I think, you know, it's already at 20 times earnings, so it's kind of, it's certainly got the market's respect in terms of being quality business. So it's not as if, you know, there have been times BlackRock's traded cheap. When people hate the market and you know, there's outflows, it actually has gotten pretty cheap. And it's not been the case because we've had pretty strong markets and they're right in the middle of it.
Yeah, I mean, alternatives also attracted some money there, $11 billion in alternatives. You know, Larry Fink has been, I think, way out front on the inflation call. Jamie Dimon also has been saying sticky inflation. But Fink early was talking about fiscal stimulus just permeating the economy, no recession. I remember when he was on with us last year talking about, I don't see a recession because we've had so much fiscal spending. And by the way, that's going to make inflation sticky. So it's interesting time to talk to him on a week where CPI surprised to the upside and has made investors rethink the entire rate view. A number of Wall Street firms today, Mike, are saying it's not going to be till December that we get a rate cut.
It could be till December.
And then that would be one cut for the year.
Exactly. And so that, you know, I was sort of dangling that out there starting a few weeks ago about, you know, this whole we're in the opposite version of 2015, where the Fed wanted to get off zero. They wanted to punctuate a whole Fed cycle, and they couldn't. The economic numbers were weak. Inflation was low. They didn't have the basis to do the multiple cuts that year that they anticipated a year earlier. And finally, in December, without the economy telling them they should, they raised rates by a quarter percentage point off of zero. So I was, you know, this is now starting to become the chatter out there.
No landing.
It's kind of a no landing, but they want to get it done. They want to finish up this cycle, I think. See if they can.
Somehow, I think you two are going to be discussing this for some time to come.
As we have been.
Always.
Yeah. I always enjoy it.
It's better when we disagree, though.
I particularly enjoy that.
Yeah.
Is there something you guys will disagree about?
We always disagree on how much yields and rates matter for stocks.
How much what?
Rates matter for stocks.
Right. Yeah.
I think they're everything. He thinks they don't matter.
All right. We're going to dig into that, see what we can do here between Mike and Sarah. But if you haven't noticed, we are on track, or at least looking for what will be a significantly lower open. It's been a volatile week. Can we call it a volatile week? Mike, all right.
Absolutely.
We've got a lot more Squawk on the Street for you when we return.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Tesla has been the subject of a number of Wall Street calls this morning, citing lowering its price target on the stock from 180 to 190, 180 from 196, maintaining a neutral rating. I believe that was Citi. Wedbush reiterated its outperform rating. They have a $300 price target. That's Dan Ives. Of course, Wells Fargo lowered its price target to 120 from 125. I don't know, Mike, whatever, Sarah. I don't know who wants to take the shot at this one.
Well, what's going on is the earnings estimates for next year are down 30% so far this year. So, in other words, you keep having to roll forward when this is going to kind of get some relief in terms of pricing and earnings falling to the bottom line. So, as the stock has come down, every analyst has to review, you know, where the valuation is. You're talking about 370, earning 370 next year is where the consensus is right now. So you're well over 40 times the lowered next year's estimates. And so now the stock has actually bounced nicely around 160 a few times. So I don't know if that's where the buyers are sitting. It's just above a $500 billion market cap.
I mean, the question is on deliveries, and that's why Wells Fargo took their price target down, expecting fewer deliveries. But they do wonder, can Elon Musk razzle dazzle investors? That's a quote. On full self-driving, he's teased the robo-taxi now. Although NBC News did an interesting story about how the California agencies that would regulate robo-taxis haven't heard from Musk. So he's teasing this is going to come out in August, but the Department of Motor Vehicles and Public Utilities Commission saying they have not applied.
There you have it, an opening bell for this Friday. And given, of course, the futures were not a surprise, that there's a lot more red on that board than green. Here at the big board, it was UL Solutions,
that's
safety
the
science
today.
Company,
yeah.
Celebrating its IPO.
Yeah,
we got an IPO. Over at the NASDAQ, European Securities and Markets Authority, the EU's financial markets regulator. All right, we were looking at the broader markets. We talked about chips. We're talking a bit about Tesla. It's funny, on Musk and the magic, I did notice the XAI effort he has underway, valued at $18 billion, with the recent raise they're trying to do of some $4 billion, which would put it far ahead of the value Fidelity has the old Twitter marked at $11
billion. Absolutely.
It's never been clear to me how the AI gets all divided up. Tesla's got its AI.
Right.
X, the platform, has Grok. And then there's XAI as well. Again, of course, a private company. Don't worry, we'll get to Tesla as well. Whose mission is to uncover the nature of the universe. Just saying.
Right. No, there's no doubt about it that, you know, the basically, the next thing is always worth more than the current thing when it comes to the Muskiverse. That's the way you should think about it.
And the AI story. Look, it's a down market, and technology and financials are at the bottom of the market, as we've been talking about. What's working, though, is energy continues to go up, thanks in part to the price of oil, which is up again today. Crude oil at $87.20. So we're really pushing some high levels. Brent crude almost at $92 per barrel. Morgan Stanley actually publishes on the energy sector this morning. Hot summer, they say, expected. They like energy, basically on the fact that oil is moving higher, and that's going to raise the earnings estimates for the entire sector. They are working off a $94 a barrel price. And it's, say gas is bottoming too.
And it's part of this general reflation trade everybody is now observing is well underway. So mining, materials, chemicals, it's all there. So you do have this phase of older economy, commodity-based stuff is working. We talked about, you know, gold as a piece of that. Copper's participating as well. Honestly, on a two-year chart, nothing looks that crazy in terms of getting out of the range. So it's still about kind of rebuilding from relatively low levels. The thing about the energy pricing at this point, too, is because the economy is so strong, because wage growth has been fine, it's not as if they're destroying a ton of demand with, you know, WTI near $90 or gasoline prices pushing $4, national average again. So it's almost like part of the bull case is we can afford it, even though the prices are up.
Gold is the number one best subsector. The gold miners are having another very strong day. Gold has been up for several weeks in a row, despite the strong dollar, whether it's geopolitical concerns, the fact that central banks have been buyers of gold.
There's China's capital flight out of China, people are saying yes. So all of it, and a technical breakout, literally to a new all-time high and something that people have been buying for thousands of years. I think it has people excited. I'm nervous at the angle of the chart, but that's just me, because I don't like things that are too easy in a short period of time. But it looks like it's got plenty of momentum here.
Apple shares actually have continued a bit of that momentum they showed yesterday. As again we pointed out, it had its biggest up day since May of last year, up 38 cents. But that revaluation, I'm not sure how to phrase it, but it's been so beat down in a way in terms of the lack of an AI strategy, I guess, is in the view of any number of investors. Suddenly that changed yesterday. There was a Bloomberg story about the iMac, including some sort of new AI AI features. And then just in general, JP Morgan sort of putting a piece out as well yesterday that seemed to capture the imagination of a number of investors, saying, is it ripe for an AI re-rating?
And I'm not even sure that it's suddenly something changed or suddenly we have insight on this. It's the stock has badly underperformed anything that looked like it in the market for, a number of weeks. It got down to these levels around 170. Everyone says that seems like a bit of a floor. The valuation comes off the boil. And, they can make these gestures to say, we're part of it. We're going to anticipate the developers conference. That's coming up. That's now within sight. And that has actually been magic for all these companies that have one of those, with the possible exception of Adobe.
I would note, in a conversation with Jim a few days ago, and having spoken to somebody who was bullish on Apple, they did talk about the opportunity there perhaps being a lot larger than people were anticipating in terms of what they can do with the coming cycle, what it will mean for the next iteration of the iPhone when AI is incorporated on that through Siri most likely, but also the fact that they have your location and tech data, they have your text messages, they have an enormous amount of data they can use to train that would be quite helpful for them in terms of targeting and information.
There's no doubt about it. They have the ingredients. The question to me is, it's almost getting to that point where the fact that iPhone has been disappointing in the upgrade cycle to this point becomes the bull case, because now you have all these older phones that need to be upgraded. We're going to hear about that coming.
Only other tech darling getting a little love today is Netflix. Price target increase, Morgan Stanley to 700. Wedbush also 725 price target. They think there's upside on subs ahead of earnings.
All right, I got something else. Well, it's down now. BlackRock. Larry Fink is sitting next to me, of course, as promised. Now it's up. All right, it's moving around a lot. But we're taking a look at shares of BlackRock, of course. The company did have an earnings beat this morning. Assets under management hit a record. They're now $10.5 trillion. And as you probably guessed, given you already saw him joining us exclusively as BlackRock's chairman and CEO, Larry Fink.
nice to have you here.
David, good to be here.
Sarah, Mike. Hope you can deal with all this noise, but nice to have an IPO,
noise, yeah.
Right? Never say that's a bad thing.
IPOs are always a good thing. Brings more capital into the market, expands the capital markets.
Yeah, actually, I might want to get to that with you, but let's start off with the earnings themselves.
Right.
You know, on the call, you're talking about the uncertain backdrop, of course, but it doesn't mean there's a lack of opportunities. You had decent inflows this quarter, interestingly more into fixed income, perhaps, than other areas, although maybe that was expected.
I think in a period of so much uncertainty, with growing fear, more anxiety throughout the world, people are staying a little close. And, you know, we've had $9 trillion of money now into money market funds, record levels, and some of that money is going into fixed income. But the alternative, though, if you were fully invested in the equity markets, you would have made 25% return. So, and this is what I try to talk about. It's not about the moment. Yes, there's uncertainty, but over the long run, do you believe in American-style capitalism? Do you believe in the markets? And over the long run, I do believe our markets are going to continue to be driving excess returns above what you could earn in a money market fund.
Right. And on the call, you talked about what you believe are still great opportunities, your words, for investors across a number of structural trends. I might expect that those include the likes of what? AI? What else?
Well, the combination, AI cannot truly happen unless there's a huge investment in infrastructure. The amount of energy that is required for AI is enormous. And the amount of power generation. We will run out of electricity if we are going to fully adapt to a full AI world. And so the need to build out, and this is all going to stimulate our economy, by the way, to build out a more AI, and which at the backside is that means building out more electricity power.
Whether that's data centers, obviously,
data centers
that
and all that.
Consume so much.
And we're going to have to be building out, you know, tens and tens of gigawatts, not megawatts, gigawatts. And that's, we're talking trillions of dollars of investing. And so the opportunity is enormous in the coming years. And this is one of the fundamental reasons why I believe the United States is leading this. But let's be clear, I'm talking to political leaders in other countries and their desire to build out data centers, AI, technology, at the same time decarbonization. So this is why I remain to be a little more constructive, why I believe there's elevated inflation in the world. And I think all of this is playing out. But back to our earnings, you know, we had a record amount of assets, $10.5 trillion.
Yes.
All of it's our clients' money. More than 50% of it is retirement. And we saw flows across the board worldwide. We had active flows where still, in many cases, active outflows are occurring in the industry. We had inflows. And so the resiliency of our business is only accelerating. For the first time in a long time, I noted our pipeline has never been stronger of noted wins that are going to fund in the future. And so what we see is acceleration in our business model.
I wanted to ask you about inflation because I gave you credit earlier for being, I think, one of the first and early ones last year to say this is going to be sticky. Inflation is going to stick around. And so we saw it come down at the end of last year. But now this year, three in a row of hotter reports.
But Sarah, never came down to the target of the Federal Reserve.
No, I'm
desire.
Saying you've been right now to call
well,
the
not yet. Not yet. Not never.
Even when everyone became enthusiastic, it never got to two.
And you don't see it getting there?
No.
For how long?
I think two is a hard number. We have restructured how we frame our economic policy. We have $1 trillion of fiscal stimulus in the CHIPS Act, the Infrastructure Act, and the IRA. We have very poor legal immigration policies that have restricted, and that is all inflationary and jobs. And then the bigger issue is how we think about how we spend our incremental dollars. As we're spending a lot more money on services. So if you think about where service inflation is really the main culprit of high elevated inflation. We have an aging housing stock in America. So our homes have more frequency of leaks from older roofs. We have more frequency of busted pipes. This is now translating into a higher elevated insurance cost. Our behavior driving, we have more frequency of accidents than any time. And that means we have elevated car insurance. So if you look at the most recent inflation numbers, so much of it was insurance. And then if you overlay what I talked about in terms of my, in my chairman's letter about elongation of life, the cost of elongation of life is going up. And long-term health care costs are going up. All those numbers were shown in the inflation number. So central banks have a harder time arresting service inflation. A great statistic that my good friend Rick Reeder uses all the time, the cost of a pair of Nikes or Adidas is about the same price for 30 years. So you'd say product prices are virtually unchanged. But the cost of going to a sporting event, the cost of going to a rock concert to see Taylor Swift is so elevated, 6-7 times. And so it's a sign that, okay, prices on goods are pretty stable. But what we're willing to pay to go to a restaurant, to go to a sporting event, has been so elevated.
So do you think the Fed is going to be able to cut rates?
When everybody said we're going to have 6 cuts earlier this year, some noted economists, I said maybe 2. And I don't, look at
the now market. Now they're saying maybe 2.
I'm still saying maybe 2.
You are.
Because the market got crazed over a 0.1% difference than the estimates. And the market went crazy over that. Okay, inflation has moderated, and we've always said inflation is going to moderate, but is going to moderate to that terminal level that the Federal Reserve is looking for? I am doubtful. Do I believe that we could get a stable inflation between 2.8 and 3%? I'd call it a day and a win.
I mean, look, we should remind folks that the PCE number, which is what the target is based on, is like 2.8. I mean, that's basically where we're going.
But is that a real good number for the average consumer? It
actually,
is not.
The reason, but why do they prefer it? It's because it's weighted by the amount of money we spend on each thing, as opposed to what people say they spend more money on. At least that's the Fed's theory.
Yeah, but if you use the same statistics, how they measured inflation in the 1980s with higher weightings in food, higher weightings in housing costs, interest rate, it was closer to probably 12.
Right, but the household budget spends so much less on food than it used to. I guess the bigger question is, regardless of what it means for the Fed, throughout the long span of history, inflation 2.5-3% plus or minus has been okay.
Call
right?
it a day.
Exactly.
That's what I
for,
but
for markets, for the economy.
So
yeah.
I do believe there's room for one or two more easings and test it out. I actually believe there are some segments of the economy that are starting to struggle. And I think I said over a year ago, the transmission of elevated interest rates in the United States are muted because most people who have a home have a 30-year mortgage. We do not have that structural problem that so many other places in the world where that have floating rate mortgages, adjustable rate mortgages, where that impact is immediate. It is very muted, it's very delayed because of the structure, which is a fantastic foundation for the American economy.
Although it is keeping a lid to a certain extent on people selling and or buying new homes right now. I mean, we have extraordinarily low numbers there.
David, it's really bad for those who need to move. And it's really bad for the young home buyers who would like to buy. So I'm not trying to suggest it's even and perfect, but it's not as severe. And the longer we have elevated interest rates, the more what you just suggested is going to be a bigger problem for the economy.
You know, Larry, when you mentioned car insurance numbers and the fact that there's unfortunately more crashes and the like right now, in part because of distracted driving, I couldn't help but think, though, about full self-driving when it comes, which then gets you to the idea of AI and what that's going to mean from both a productivity enhancement and potentially as a sort of a deflationary aspect as well. But I'm curious how you think about the advent, particularly of generative AI of late, in your business and throughout the corporate world.
Well, I think AI will be will totally transform the business world, the corporate world. If you intersect AI with improved sensor technology, and in addition to that, to improved robotics, it's not only going to transform the business side, the back office, it's going to transform how we manufacture. And BlackRock started our AI lab in 2018 at Stanford University. It has really helped us improve. Some of our active growth is in our systematic equity team that uses AI, and our performance over 10 years is about 93% above consistent performance. We believe that AI will transform how we think, how we invest. Data retrieval, information retrieval will be essential. We are using AI to revolutionize our Aladdin system that we provide our technology system to so many people. So I'm so neurotic about AI. I think AI is going to transcend.
Well, when you say neurotic, is it both a concern or just that you're not using it as effectively as you could? Or
all of the
above.
What
does that mean? What's your neurosis based on?
Neurosis, are we moving fast enough? Are we cautious enough? Are we making sure we have the structure in place to make sure we could utilize it properly? Are we focusing on how we could use new technologies and AI to improve the workforce at BlackRock and improve how we work with our clients and how do we build deeper, better relationships? It's a very complex issue. I also believe we're going to be using AI to transcend how we live. I mean, Elon Musk, you were talking about earlier about robo-taxis. I mean, if you think about an automobile, it's a very expensive capital expenditure for something that you use for 10 hours a week. And if there is an advancement towards more and more robo-taxis in cities, think about that. If you don't have to put all that money down on owning a car, more people probably could own a home. There's so many wonderful transformations in society that technology is going to do to improve most people's quality of life. I was with a CEO earlier this week, and this CEO said to me, we are going to use more technology than ever before. And it means as we grow our business, as a percent of our business, we'll have fewer human beings as a percent of our business, but each employee will have higher wages.
Right.
So you're going to be able to do that. And look at BlackRock and our earnings. We've raised assets over $1.5 trillion in the last 18 months and did not add a job. That is productivity.
Although, man, all those people who may not be working and maybe we have to, I don't know what we do for them. And by the way, what about their retirement savings, which you spent a lot of time in your letter on recently talking about and being concerned about, again, to these transformational changes you're talking about.
But they're going to create new jobs, too. Think about all the needs for building out data centers and management. It's going to reshape our jobs. Let's be clear. Think about all the jobs that have been lost in society, whether telephone operators, even from, there's so many jobs that have been eliminated, but we have 3.7 unemployment. Over time, we create new jobs. And unfortunately, there's a timing differential. And in many cases, a geographic differential. But look, between decarbonization, between what we're doing in our own country related to hydrocarbons. Think about, we went from 8 million barrels of energy in the United States to 13 million barrels of energy, all on new technology. So we're not focusing on how technology has reshaped even something like energy extraction, energy identification. And it's going to be the same technological transformation that is going to build other industries into new job creations. And so I actually believe we should be enthusiastic and front-centered on it. And I do believe this is what's going to be leading the United States to be the strongest economy in the world.
I just want to ask you finally about China, because I was there this week, and while you're thinking about big picture investment themes, there are some serious questions about where the geopolitics go between the U.S. and China and where the economic growth comes from in China and whether we've seen the peak. How are you thinking about it?
So getting back to my chairman's letter, I talk about hope and fear. I think the biggest fundamental undiscussed question about China is the fear within China. We're spending so much time talking about imports, exports. China right now is a 35% savings rate, the highest savings rate in the world. And they're most of that savings rate because they're frightened of the real estate market now. They don't have a retirement system. They don't have a healthcare system. And so the savings rates are extraordinarily high. They're not consuming. And so China, knowing that they don't have a strong domestic economy, is trying to export its way out of its problem. And that remains to be a problem. And if you look at in most advanced economies, the domestic consumption is generally 70%+ of GDP. In China, it's 30%, and most of it is export. And that there lies a paradigm problem between the world and China and the world. China needs to develop more hope within its country more opportunity in that country. So that's the statistic I look at. What is a savings rate? It's a pretty simple thing to look at. And if the savings rates go lower and they're starting to consume more, that's a good outcome. But during COVID, actually in China, because of the behaviors of China and the lockdown, savings rates in China was 50% of disposable income. Okay, that's not a good thing. And that's why we need to focus on these simple concepts of hope and fear, and then translating that to savings rates. And in China, that is the most important statistic to look at. Whether they can find different places to export, that's going to be a big question. But I think Secretary Yellen said some very appropriate issues related to if China is not going to be able to export its problem out of it, it's going to have to advance its own economy. And let's see how that plays out.
Larry, thank you for being here, for stopping by. Appreciate it, as always.
Good to be here.
Larry Fink, the chairman and CEO of BlackRock.
Speaking of China, it's certainly a topic for our next conversation, an exclusive interview coming up with Nike CEO John Donahoe in the next hour. Before we head to break, let's quickly hit the bond report, show you what treasuries are doing. There's a bid today for bonds, which is a reverse of what we've seen for the past few weeks. 10-year note yield, though, remains above 4.5%, so elevated, even though they're getting bought with lower yields today. We'll be right back.
Top Amazon executive says it is a myth that robots and other technologies take jobs away from people. Take a listen to what the company's director of global robotics told CNBC Europe yesterday.
It is a myth that technology robots take out jobs. The number you mentioned is already a demonstration of that, because robots and technology help our employees, for example, by reducing walking distance between assignments, by taking away repetitive motion, or by helping them to lift heavy weight. And in turn, our employees can learn new skills, they can learn new competencies, acquire new capabilities that allow them to progress towards their career objectives.
Hundreds of thousands of people obviously employed in distribution centers owned by Amazon.
I was going to say, well, they have, I think, 750,000 robots and 1.5 million people. So that jives with what he says.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, it takes away jobs from certain specific people. But I mean, look, the auto plants, integrated robotics decades ago, right? And yeah. I mean, it's sort of a supplement.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what it looks like. But they are adding more and more robotics all the time in the distribution centers. So two positive takes, at least, on the coming of advancement of technology.
Larry Fink
saying AI won't take jobs as well. Yeah.
Productivity.
Yeah.
People make more and
you
do more
You want to be on
things.
The right side of the robots when they start to take over.
I'm all with you. I know. I don't know where I'm going. Once they have general artificial intelligence in the robots, it exceeds our own.
But can they have your hair?
Still concerned. No.
We all have to know what our edge is.
The answer is no. All right.
Mine?
She went with a hair, not the mind. Coming up, an exclusive Nike CEO John Donahoe is going to be a guest on Squawk on the Street. Don't go anywhere.
You've been listening to the opening hour of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
All opinions expressed by the Squawk on the Street participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information Squawk on the Street participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Squawk on the Street disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Squawk on the Street disclaimer.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.